It's 9 o'clock, and on a Thursday night, and it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And let's start with a announcement or two. Here's an invitation to join the Christmas bird count in the Alameda Creek watershed on December 17th. I believe that's a Saturday coming up. Maybe it's a Friday. Friday, that's it. Join us next week in surveying wintering birds in the Alameda Creek watershed. The Alameda Creek Alliance and the Ohlone Audubon Society invite you to participate in the second annual Eastern Alameda County Christmas Bird Count on Friday, December 17th. Beginning birders and aspiring ornithologists are welcome. The bird count circle is in the vicinity of the towns of Sunol, Pleasanton, and Livermore and includes five East Bay regional parks. Significant Southern Fremont Public Utility, watershed lands, public watershed lands, and exciting East Bay birding hotspots such as Lower Mines Road, Sunol Wilderness, San Antonio Reservoir, and Springtown Preserve. The inaugural count last year had over 75 volunteers who found 144 bird species in the count circle. Highlight species from 2009 included bald eagles, well over 20 golden eagles, prairie falcons, northern pygmy owls, short-eared owls, burrowing owls, Lewis's woodpeckers, 176 yellow-billed magpies, rock wrens, canyon wrens, tricolored blackbirds, and rufous-crowned lark, vesper, and grasshopper sparrows. If you're interested in participating or in being an area count leader, contact Rich Cimino, and that is RSCIMINO at earthlink.net. That's RSCIMINO at earthlink.net, or you might give them a call at 925-353-0266. Of course, there will be bird counts going on in the Santa Cruz area and all around the United States. The Christmas bird count is a significant ornithological event every year. The Ohlone Audubon is also sponsoring a Christmas bird count in the lower portion of the watershed, the Hayward-Fremont count, and that count will be held on Sunday, December 19th, and you need to contact Ohlone Audubon for that. They're over in the East Bay. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has extended the comment period on their draft Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Plan. While the 2010 plan is far better than the Bush administration's 2008 recovery plan, peer reviews reveal shortcomings that need to be addressed if the old-growth forest-dependent owl is going to have a chance of recovery. The northern spotted owl is declining rapidly, 4% per year across its range, a pattern that must be reversed with stronger conservation measures in the final recovery plan. Take action. Go to www.kswild.org. And click on Take Action when you get there. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. This winter is already shaping up to be a very challenging one for America's last wild population of buffalo. Eight buffalo have been killed by Confederated Salish Kootenai tribal members in the past week, bringing the total killed in the hunt to 10. State and federal agents have conducted two more hazing operations inside Yellowstone National Park's northern boundary. In Gardner, that's on the north side of Yellowstone, three bull buffalo we had been watching had their world drastically changed when one of them was shot Saturday afternoon. Staying close to their comrades' remains, the other two bulls were extremely vulnerable, and the following morning one of them was also killed. The last one, left all alone with the ravens, vacated the area to try and live another day and perhaps seek the company of other buffalo. It broke our hearts to see him in solitude he did not choose, and we can only hope he succeeded in finding more companions. While the hunt is underway in the relative highlands east of the Yellowstone River, down on the west side of the river, hazing operations are underway. Inside Yellowstone, a group of nine bulls were hazed by four Yellowstone Park wranglers on Saturday morning. They never even migrated outside the park. On Wednesday morning, another group of three bulls that had made it across the boundary were hazed back into Yellowstone by Park Service and Montana Department of Livestock riders. Near West Yellowstone, not far from the park boundary, buffalo have been killed in the hunt nearly every other day since Saturday. Three buffalo, a bull, a cow, and a yearling were shot on Saturday. On Tuesday, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols confirmed two more cow buffalo killed, and yesterday one more buffalo was taken by a hunter. Blood red, snow white, and raven black starkly contrast with one another, painting a sorrowful portrait of the buffalo hunt. The buffalo that have been killed in the hunt are very few of the very first to emigrate from Yellowstone's high elevation country. The buffalo that are first to migrate are important messengers and teachers for other herd members. These lead animals show the way, blazing the trail for others to follow. This migratory instinct should be protected, preserved, and allowed to flourish and to flow if the footsteps of the buffalo are to carry their descendants into a healthy future. If you want to find out more about the work of the Buffalo Field Campaign, please go to their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and they have several pages about what they need and how to become a volunteer. You should read those very carefully. If you feel like donating to the Buffalo Field Campaign, you can send your check to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Address again, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions for them, give them a call, 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. Once again, the webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And in news from Cancun, the voices of those who speak from other earth must not be silenced in this letter from Cancun by Tom Goldtooth, the executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, a really great group. He writes, I have come to the UNFCCC COP16 climate talks in Cancun, Mexico, as a member of Grassroots Solutions for Climate Justice, North America's delegation of indigenous peoples and representatives from fossil fuel-impacted communities who are on the front lines of addressing the climate crisis. On Tuesday, December 7th, I spoke at a Via Campesina press conference of social movement and civil society leaders inside the Moon Palace, hosted by our allies, the Global Justice Ecology Project. Together with my brothers and sisters from Via Campesina, Friends of the Earth, Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, and allies from around the world, we expressed our solidarity with the many diverse communities and movements participating in the 1,000 Cancun Days of Action for Climate Justice. I also stated my deep concerns that the COP negotiations are failing to address the core issue of reducing emissions and have instead become a trade show for promoting false solutions and generating capital. We were honored to be joined by Pablo Salón, UN ambassador from Bolivia, and together we left the talks to join the thousands of people rallying outside in the streets in a people's assembly addressing the real community-led solutions to the climate crisis. On Wednesday, December 8th, when I returned to the Moon Palace to continue my role in the negotiations, I was denied entry, informed that my accreditation had been suspended and then removed from, and then I was removed from the grounds. I also learned that over a dozen of my brothers and sisters from other accredited civil society organizations were also denied entry. I am pleased to report that due to the support of both government and civil society allies who advocated on my behalf, that as of this morning, my accreditation has now been reinstated. To everyone who assisted the Indigenous Environmental Network and myself, we issue our deepest thanks and gratitude. However, even though I have been fortunate enough to regain my personal access to the negotiations, the treatment I received is indicative of a larger and disturbing pattern in which the voices of civil society are being silenced within the United Nations process. The UNFCCC has drastically limited the number of civil society representatives allowed inside the talks, and increasingly our freedom of speech and right to peaceful protest is being withdrawn. We must stand united against this type of censorship that is designed to silence the mass opposition of the co-optation of the UN process by an unholy alliance of short-term thinking, denial, and greed. I have included below a statement, which I don't have time for today, from the members of our delegation who were ejected on the 7th of December and continue to be denied access to the talks, though some of them have since been let back in, including Peter Rainsborough, who is a Canadian organizer. Both inside and outside the UN process, the voices of indigenous peoples, social movements, and the communities most directly affected by our fossil fuel dependency must continue to be heard as we reject false solutions like the carbon market mechanisms of RED, R-E-D-D. We demand that the Cochabamba People's Agreement be acknowledged as a path towards addressing the real solutions to the climate crisis based on traditional indigenous knowledge, community-based practices, indigenous and human rights, and the rights of Mother Earth. And a statement by Tom Goldtooth, who's the executive director of Indigenous Environmental Network, a network of indigenous peoples empowering indigenous nations and communities towards sustainable livelihoods, demanding environmental justice, and maintaining the sacred fire of our traditions. The Indigenous Environmental Network has brought 17 indigenous leaders to Cancun as part of the Grassroots Solutions for Climate Justice North American delegation, uniting representatives from fossil fuel impacted communities who are on the front lines of solving the climate crisis. And if you don't know what a fossil fuel impacted community is, think about the tar sands development in central Canada, as well as gas development and other development on native lands. And here's for some good news. Rare bird has been protected by groundbreaking land deal in Peru. For the first time in Peru, conservationists have purchased privately owned lands within a national protected area and then donated them to the national government. 29 privately owned properties totaling 1,196 acres within Peru's Alpajayo Mishana National Preserve were donated on December 1st to SERNAP, the government agency that administers national protected areas. The donated lands are home to the Iquitos gnatcatcher, a critically endangered bird first described in 2005. The 143,500-acre Alpajayo Mishana National Preserve is located only 15 miles from the city of Iquitos in northern Peru, protecting rare white sand forests that are home to rare and unique plants and animals. This reserve is one of the most important places for birds in Peru, supporting a community of 19 bird species and is the only home for the critically endangered Iquitos gnatcatcher, said Dr. Daniel Levin, conservation biologist with the American Bird Conservancy, the leading U.S. bird conservation organization, and one of the key supporters of the acquisitions. When the Alpajayo Mishana National Reserve was created, much of the land remained under private ownership. Continued timber extraction, charcoal production, and land clearance for agriculture on privately owned inholdings within the reserve continued to damage the reserve's forests and reduce habitat for its threatened wildlife. The protected area was first declared as a reserve zone in 1999 and elevated to a national reserve in 2004. With the support of the American Bird Conservancy, ConocoPhillips, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and the Robert W. Wilson Charitable Trust, Pro Naturaleza, a leading Peruvian conservation organization, purchased the land from willing sellers in the eastern portion of the reserve where Iquitos gnatcatchers live. The donation of this land to SERNAMP allows us to better manage it for conservation, said Carlos F. Rivera Gonzalez, the head of the Alpajayo Mishana National Reserve. To achieve the success, Pro Naturaleza worked in cooperation with a coalition including SERNAMP and other environmental groups such as Friends of the Alpajayo Mishana and Canatura, a group conducting environmental education, among others. This experience is a clear example of joint work between public and private institutions benefiting the management of the Alpajayo Mishana National Reserve, the pride of Iquitos, said Martin Alcalde, executive director of Pro Naturaleza. We hope to build on this success to purchase more inholdings to later donate to SERNAP if additional funds become available. ACAAM also purchased private property along the reserve's border, which will help protect national additional forests. The Iquitos gnatcatcher was the first scientifically described in 2005 and is currently ranked as critically endangered under the IUCN World Conservation Union criteria due to its restricted range, less than 8 square miles, roughly 5,000 acres. Its tiny population, fewer than 50 pairs, and the threat of deforestation poses to its remaining white sands forest habitat. The Alpajayo Mishana National Reserve is recognized by the Alliance for Zero Extinction as one of the 587 sites worldwide where conservation is critical to prevent species extinction. Alliance for Zero Extinction is a global initiative of 68 biodiversity conservation organizations in 18 countries, which aim to prevent extinctions by identifying and safeguarding key sites where species are in imminent danger of disappearing. Because of the extremely high levels of endemism, Peru has the world's third highest number of AZE sites. That's 36 after Mexico, which has 68, and Colombia, which has 46. And I guess that's... The American Bird Conservancy conserves native birds and their habitats throughout the Americas by safeguarding their rarest species, conserving and restoring habitats, and reducing threats while building the capacity of the bird conservation movement. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Their webpage, www.abcbirds.org. And now it's time for our monthly forest update from Jody Frediani, forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz group of the Ventana chapter of the Sierra Club. And December 16th is an important Air Resources Board hearing, Clear Cuts for the Climate. On December 16th, the California Air Resources Board will consider adopting a cap-and-trade program that would allow industrial polluters to purchase carbon offset credits instead of reducing their own greenhouse gas emissions. Under the current proposal, a large number of those carbon offset credits would come from projects that allow clear-cutting. This is insane. This could even include clear-cutting old growth. The proposed cap-and-trade rule would also allow industrial polluters to avoid greenhouse gas emission limits by burning forest biomass, including whole live trees, to generate energy. The biomass combustion would be exempt from the carbon cap, even though the actual greenhouse gas emissions would be even higher than burning fossil fuels. And the SoCal Demonstration State Forest financial saga continues. After 6 months of repeated requests, I finally received 5 years of expense reports for the SoCal Demonstration State Forest. No income records were included, so the hunt continues. Initially, CAL FIRE said there were no income records because there was no income. The money must have come from somewhere, the general fund, perhaps. In addition, my sleuthing uncovered 3 dead, dying, or diseased and fuel wood exemptions on the SDSF property during the past 5 years, and what happened to the income from those. There is a column for other staff benefits in the expense records. In 2005 and 2006, the amount listed was over $22,000. For 2007, the amount was $25,202. In 2008, the amount was $32,167, and in 2009, the figure was over $13,000. I have asked for a clarification on this benefit, as medical and dental and other benefits are included elsewhere, and stay tuned, because she may get an answer to that one eventually. And item number 3, Graham Hill Roadhouse Site Conversion Exemption. In late November, I was contacted about some clear-cutting along Graham Hill Road. Upon investigation, I learned this is a 3-acre conversion for a new house. They have a building permit from the county, but they do not have a winter grading permit. In fact, they were issued a winter grading warning in October that no winter grading was to occur. They do have an exemption from CAL FIRE and a less than 3-acre conversion exemption permit. They can essentially remove all the trees within the boundary, which is approximately 2 acres, except for any that are 200 years old and 60 inches diameter breast height if redwood, or 48 inches DBH if Doug fir. This is a less than 3-acre conversion exemption where all trees within the footprint of the permitted structures will be removed completely and the surrounding forest will be thinned to reduce the vertical continuity of fuels, unquote. Here's another excerpt from the conversion winter operating plan amendment. The soil itself is rather prone to erosion, so care must be taken to stabilize soils and install erosion control structures before the rains arrive. They already have. General logging season, May 1st to October 15th. Winter period, October 16th through April 30th. Erosion control must be installed during the winter period prior to sunset if 30% or greater chance of rain is forecast before the next day, or 10 days, whichever is less. And that is, erosion control structures and soil stabilization measures will be installed. Treatments shall be applied and include mulching with 90% cover of any exposed areas. These are all quotes from the permit. Log hauling, loading, and skidding operations shall only be allowed when soils are not saturated. Operation of trucks and heavy equipment on roads and landings shall be limited to those with a stable operating surface. Of course, that all means, and Scott Bullock of CAL FIRE agreed, that they should not have been moving heavy equipment off-site in November when it was tracking mud onto Graham Hill Road. I asked Scott to conduct a site visit and report back to me on his findings. After a reminder, he emailed that all trees were cut in accordance with the regs and the riparian was being properly protected. However, he neglected to mention anything about erosion control treatments. And the Silver Bullet THP 1-10-080 San Mateo update. Last month, we noted the Department of Fish and Game has concerns about the 251-acre Big Creek Timber Harvest Plan 1-10-80 SMO on their property along the North Fork of Butano Creek. Department of Fish and Game is very concerned about the amount of water the THP will need to draft to keep extensive road system watered. This month, the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board has chimed in with their concerns in a 7-page pre-harvest inspection report. They acknowledge that the THP is part of the 4,000-acre tract Big Creek purchased from Pacific Lumber in 1993. The plan area, quote, has been significantly modified by historic logging, most notably extensive grading activities to create a network of roads, skid trails, landings, and stream crossings, most of which are hydraulically connected to watercourses. That means if sediment's moving on the roads, it moves into the watercourses. Logging during the 1950s and 60s resulted in, quote, extensive impairment to the watershed due to the introduction of large amounts of sediment, unquote. 30 existing landings are proposed for reuse and 19 in-lieu practices are proposed. Quote, numerous watercourse crossings are anticipated and winter operations are also proposed, unquote. 7 general recommendations have been made, including insistence that Big Creek prepare a, quote, comprehensive road inventory and maintenance plan for all roads within their Butano Creek and Pescadero Creek watershed holdings. Proper installation of water bars and mulching slash packing where appropriate, identification of potential sediment delivery problem areas and efforts to fix them, including elimination of unnecessary roads, outsloping of roads, removal of inside drainage dishes, etc. Additionally, quote, all proposed watercourse crossings and skid trails should be considered temporary, unquote. Another 9 specific recommendations were made, including the need to contract a civil geotechnical engineer and or a certified engineering geologist to aid in bridge design and construction. And our next article, Southern Steelhead Resources Evaluation Now Available. From the executive summary, reduced habitat availability due to the creation of passage barriers and habitat degradation are the likeliest causes of steelhead decline. Ongoing conservation efforts are producing inspiring results throughout the region south of San Francisco, with many local, regional, state, and federal agencies cooperating with non-governmental organizations and others to address passage and habitat quality issues in steelhead streams. Nevertheless, the continuing perilous condition of steelhead suggests that a well-reasoned comprehensive program to protect the best steelhead resources and alleviate continuing threats be developed as quickly as possible. This report responds to this need, recognizing limitations on funding, expertise, political will, and the agency and non-governmental organizational staff time to identify a vital set of restoration actions in the regionally significant watersheds and streams, unquote. The report assembles for the first time all readily available information regarding steelhead habitat and watersheds draining to the Pacific Ocean south of San Francisco. And the full text can be downloaded in PDF at the OPC, that's the Ocean Protection Council website, or CEMAR, which is the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration website. So check those out. And the NOAA NIMS supports desalinization. A November 22nd letter from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to the Santa Cruz Desal Alternatives. NOAA expressed support for desalinization to address, quote, the water supply challenges facing the city of Santa Cruz, unquote. Here are a few excerpts from the letter. Quote, the San Lorenzo River and Soquel Creek watersheds are in severe overdraft as evidenced by the fact the San Lorenzo is adjudicated during the summer. That means the water has to be apportioned according to a plan. And the Soquel Creek is adjudicated year-round. Water diversions have resulted in major adverse impacts to all life stages of salmon and steelhead in the Santa Cruz County streams. We acknowledge your concerns regarding the city's proposed desalinization effort, but we also observe that the city is the only entity that has actively engaged the National Marine Fisheries Service for the last number of years to address impacts associated with water diversions to the county fishery. We believe desalination is one of the many necessary steps that will need to be taken in the county to begin addressing the impacts from diversion. We support the City of Santa Cruz's pursuit of desalination as the best alternative for a new source of water supply, taking the pressure off in-stream diversions with the use of desalination water. Needed flows for migration, spawning, and rearing habitat could be made available for fish in a relatively short time frame. We believe this desalination project, in combination with an integrated countywide effort that includes all major diverters and water agencies, will be necessary to ensure the long-term recovery of listed salmonids in the watersheds of Santa Cruz County. And bear in mind, it is only the city of Santa Cruz and the city of Soquel water districts that are going to participate in desalinization. However, there are quite a number of water districts within the county, and none of them coordinate at the present time. And moving on to winter log hauling, winter operations on all Santa Cruz timber harvest should have been shut down once we had 4 inches of cumulative rainfall. That would include log hauling as well. However, I keep seeing loaded log trucks on the roads. I am continuing to bug Cal Fire about this. The first such truck was seen and felt just before Thanksgiving and was a truck and trailer rig with the equivalent of 2 full loads of large logs. Cal Fire had no idea who might be hauling. And then last night I saw another truck with a good-sized logs parked along Empire Grade. If anyone knows where these logs are coming from, contact Jody Frediani and Cal Fire in Felton. And we want to thank Jody Frediani for her monthly forestry news for Santa Cruz Mountains. Jody Frediani is the forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz group of the Ventana chapter of the Sierra Club and also for other Sierra Club groups. And if you wanted to contact her, her email is jodifredi@aol.com. jodifredi@aol.com. That'd be the best way to contact her. And Cal Fire's office in Felton is in the phone book. Of course, you can also get that at calfire.ca.gov, I believe. And I've got a story here about the Salmon Summit that we don't have time for, and I have a whole bunch of biological diversity news that we'll have to get to on another night. But want to thank you for tuning in to the Earth First Update tonight. The Earth First Update is a weekly newscast brought to you every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you would like to download a previous Earth First Update or listen to a podcast, here's the place to go. H2Opodcast.com. That's www.H2Opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we do want to thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and archiving those shows for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another edition of Earth First Updates.